exercise, tennis, skiing, horseback riding. We compromised somewhat in Scotland. Between rainstorms, I persuaded the king to go for walks with me on the famous Gleneagles golf course or across the Scottish moors. He was obliging, but he still preferred to drive. Hussein's passion for cars stemmed from his schoolboy years at Harrow. That passion had been stoked, I am sure, by the reluctance of the royal court in Jordan to let him get behind the wheel of a car. No one at the royal court wanted the responsibility of sanctioning a license for the 17-year-old heir to the throne. So he passed his driving exam in England instead, and bought the first of many cars. I was less interested in the car itself than where it would take us, and there arose another difference. I loved exploring little roads and lanes in Scotland, not knowing quite where we were or what we might find. Hussein loved to explore, too, but he was more destination-oriented. One day during our honeymoon, for example, he decided he wanted to show me Sandhurst, where he had completed his military training, and within minutes we were in the car heading for Surrey. Once on the grounds, he proudly showed me the statue of Queen Victoria, to whom Sandhurst cadets, if guilty of some infraction, were ordered to pay their respects. While on parade, they would run off in disgrace to salute and then return to their fellow cadets on the parade ground. My husband liked to know exactly where he was and where he was going, which stemmed, I am sure, from his many years behind the controls of helicopters and airplanes. Hussein had been taught to fly by a Scot, Jock Dalgleish. They had met at a tragic moment. Jock, then a wing commander in the British Air Force on loan to the Jordanian military, was at the airstrip outside of Jerusalem when 16-year-old Hussein arrived in shock after witnessing the murder of his grandfather, King Abdullah. Everyone seemed at a loss as to what to do. Except Jock. He took Hussein over to his grandfather's Dove, a twin-engine aircraft, put him in the co-pilot's seat, and flew him back to Amman. Hussein never forgot that kindness, and the two men developed a lifelong bond that centered on their mutual passion for flying. Once again, the royal court had disapproved of the crown prince's new enthusiasm. Even Jock tried to discourage him by taking Hussein up and putting the plane through so many extreme aerial maneuvers that the young prince got airsick. But Hussein was determined. Not only did he have the same love for flying as he did for cars, his ambition was to build a first-class air force in Jordan. If he flew, then other young men in the kingdom would want to fly. So he continued his flight training, and when he was ready, defied the orders given by the royal court to Jock, the other pilots, and every mechanic on the ground. Do not let the crown prince fly solo. He simply got into an airplane one day when no one was looking, and took off. You could say that without Jock, I might never have met the king. It was Jock's fixation with flying that had first introduced Hussein to the flying bug. Hussein's passion, my father's passion, and my own love of adventure had combined to put the king and me in the same place at the same time. Jock and my husband reminisced happily over tea in Jock's cottage outside Edinburgh, reliving another dramatic event, their own near-death experience 20 years earlier in the air over Syria. It was Jock who had taken over the controls of the old Dove during the attack, and literally skimmed the plane just over the ground to evade the Syrian fighter jets and escape into Jordanian airspace. My husband told me that it was the closest he had ever come to losing his life. Hussein never lost touch with his old friends, and Jock held a special place in his affections. When Jock was getting on in years, my husband arranged for his UK helicopter pilot, Richard Verrill, to fly the Dove to Scotland on 2 occasions so that Jock could fly the aircraft again. Jock was well into his 70s by then and had not been in the plane for more than 30 years, but Richard said his hands worked the levers as if time had stood still. We both enjoyed the visit with Jock, but there was no getting around the dreary weather. The driving rain was not letting up, and I was uncomfortably cold all the time. I had simply not packed with this contingency in mind. I had been so busy getting together my dress and shoes for the wedding that there had been no opportunity for me to organize a trousseau or even suitable clothes for the honeymoon. A friend of my husband's from London had brought some outfits to Amman, but they were essentially cruise wear for a Caribbean holiday. After 4 days of terrible weather and very little privacy, we had our close call with the noxious fumes. That sealed it. We decided to leave the next morning for London, where Hussein owned a house on a private road across from Kensington Palace that had formerly served as the Jordanian embassy. At the time, he usually stayed at Claridge's Hotel rather than the house, but over time I persuaded him that Palace Green would be more private and secure. Palace Green was a large five-story house that the king had bought from the government some years back when they were going to sell it. He had lived in it for a while, had given it to his second wife when they divorced, then had bought it back from her. It was a pattern I would get used to. He rarely sold property. Instead, he would give it away. Palace Green had family quarters on the upper floors and more formal reception rooms on the ground floor. My husband's English secretary of 25 years worked out of one of the guest rooms on the second floor and had set up a typewriter on a dressing table. There was no switchboard, and when the phone rang, my husband would often answer it. I soon discovered how busy the king would be whenever we spent time in London. On our honeymoon, he was quickly inundated by requests from Jordanians, the press, diplomats, and ordinary citizens for audiences. The workload simply carried over from Amman to London. I found myself alone much of the time, and adrift in the midst of the whirlwind of activity. Nothing in my life had prepared me for what I now understood would be an everyday reality. Our marriage would be one in which we would fight to find private time together amid the press of events. In fact, our bathroom would become the only reliable sanctuary for the two of us. Often it was the only place where we could talk with complete freedom. Given all the stress that King Hussein had lived through, and the extraordinary challenges and crises he continued to face, I determined very early in our marriage that as much as possible I would try not to add to that stress by burdening him with problems or needs of my own. It was not always easy to keep that pledge, especially on our honeymoon, when I was still getting to know the man I had married. The demands on his time were so constant and so varied that I felt increasingly frustrated. I was not only a young bride after a short courtship, but by virtue of my marriage to Hussein, a stepmother to 8 children. I already felt close to his 3 youngest, Abir, Haya, and Ali, with whom I had spent many happy moments during our courtship. After my marriage to their father, they would call me Mama or Mummy. However, I hardly knew his other children, Alia, his eldest, Abdullah and Faisal, and his twins, Zain and Aisha, except for what he had told me about the challenges they had faced in the course of his previous 3 marriages. Hussein's older children would call me Abla Nur, which translates to Big Sister. Over the years, I tried as much as possible to include all the children, and, when appropriate, their mothers, in family gatherings, hoping that regular contact would bring us closer and reduce whatever tensions might exist. I wish I could say that this strategy was an unequivocal success. In hindsight, I think I was a little naive. I believed that if I exuded positive feelings, these would be returned in kind. It was not that simple. Misunderstandings would bubble up not infrequently, even though I am convinced that all of us, parents, step-parent, and children alike, wanted the complex situation to work. One of the most enjoyable aspects of our London stay was meeting some of Hussein's old friends, We spent time with the Jordanian ambassador to Britain, Ibrahim Izzeddin, and his wife, Noor. Both were bright, positive, and supportive. Ibrahim and Hussein had grown up in the same neighborhood and had learned how to ride a bike together. While they met at the embassy, Noor and I found time to talk, and I was immediately drawn to her gentle wisdom and mischievous sense of humor. She also helped me in my search for an antique prayer rug, a present for my husband. We also had a delightful day in the country at the home of Tessa Kennedy, a distinguished interior designer in England and a longtime friend of my husband's. She had met Hussein in 1967, introduced by the British ambassador in Amman at the time, Charles Johnson. Her mother, hoping to block her marriage to a young painter whom she considered an unsuitable match, had taken Tessa on an extended trip through the Middle East. It did not work. 17-year-old Tessa created a society scandal when she eloped the day she returned to England. She and Hussein remained close friends through the years. He was godfather to her daughter, Milika, and Tessa and her family often visited Jordan during the Easter holidays or in the summer. Over lunch at her house in the country, I gave Tessa my account of our honeymoon, which we spent nearly frozen in Scotland, and of our near-death experience. Then we played a spirited game of croquet on the lawn, surrounded by a large cedar of Lebanon, a weeping rowan, and other magnificent trees. The setting, the weather, and the company all made for a perfect occasion. Tessa told me later that my sense of humor about nearly being gassed to death in that bungalow convinced her that the marriage would work. It turned out that Hussein had called her soon after he had met me and said, "I think I've found someone. I have been really miserable, and I am happy at last. My life is going to turn around." What I found most unsettling from the beginning of our marriage was the drip, drip, drip of gossip about Hussein's friends and family. Upon our arrival in London from Scotland, I was introduced to his secretary, a loyal and dedicated woman who was also quite possessive and protective. Shortly after our first meeting, she began to criticize most of the people surrounding the king. Seemingly without inhibition, she scrolled through a list of Hussein's friends. His previous wives and children were also fair game. I tried to veer her onto neutral subjects, but to no avail. I had never been exposed to such gossip, and I began to wonder about the world I had married into. Another difficult adjustment concerned our personal finances. First of all, I found the whole concept of spending someone else's money difficult to adapt to. I was accustomed to earning and spending my own income. After we married, the royal court budgetary systems and my husband's finances seemed both mysterious and beyond my control. All I knew for certain was that I was not supposed to worry about money. But what did that mean? On the one hand, I knew the king would not set limits on me, though he had made references to past extravagance. On the other hand, I had been raised to set responsible limits for myself. It was a puzzlement. I did not know what the requirements were as his wife, as a queen. So there were the inevitable awkward moments. "Why don't you go shopping with my secretary?" my husband often suggested when he was tied up in meetings during our stay in London. He presumed that I loved to shop. But this was my honeymoon, and I wanted to spend it getting to know my husband. One day, feeling somewhat overwhelmed by it all, I decided I needed a change in atmosphere and contacted my friend Fatina Asfour, who was newly married and living in London. My husband had several cars garaged at Palace Green and probably drivers standing by as well, but I told his secretary I would be happy to take a cab. However, when it came time for me to return, I realized I did not know the address of the London house or even the phone number. I called the Jordanian embassy, but it had already closed for the day. Somehow, by trial and error, Fatina and I determined where I needed to go, and she drove me back to the gated residence. all the while I was wondering if, having exited the rabbit hole from the surreal world surrounding the king, I could re-enter, and even whether I actually wanted to return. Was it all just a strange dream? There was a decidedly Alice in Wonderland quality to the situation. When we finally arrived, the gates to the house were closed, which only reinforced the sensation. I gulped and rang the doorbell, and a guard let me in. In truth, the only thing drawing me back to those four walls was my husband. We had been married less than 2 weeks. I truly loved him, and I believed fervently in his quest for peace. Granted, the quiet rituals we had observed during our courtship, dinners and movies and talking alone together, were now less frequent, but there would be other ways to get to know each other and for me to learn more about his world. Even now, on our honeymoon, politics had become our constant companion. From those days onward, wherever we would go in the world, a black shortwave radio as large as a briefcase would sit on the nightstand, our waking and nightly connection to current events. I was already familiar with the critical events in the region, but I knew them, mainly through books and newspapers, as a series of struggles and crises that seemed to unfold almost inevitably, one event upon another. But now it seemed that the lifeblood of human beings was being spilled or saved with every decision. I could see that to my husband this was living history, and it preoccupied his every hour. He framed his life and work in terms of his Hashemite heritage and the search for peace. Jordan faced a unique political challenge. Many of its citizens identified strongly with their Palestinian heritage and actively sought the return to the land of their forebears. When the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, was created in 1964, it was only natural that many Jordanians of Palestinian origin supported a political movement that promised to restore their property and rights in Palestine itself. King Hussein hoped that one day a permanent peace settlement in Palestine would give Jordanians of Palestinian origin the choice of either remaining in Jordan or returning to their homeland. That was a goal we all worked for. But in the meantime, all Jordanian citizens were viewed as members of a single family, with a shared commitment to build the country. Hussein continued to press for an Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories. He had welcomed the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians displaced by the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza after the 1967 war, but he had forbidden the extremists among them to establish bases on Jordanian soil from which to mount guerrilla operations against Israel. The Palestinian guerrilla groups that made up the PLO, among them Fatah, led by Yasser Arafat, were of another mind. Their intent, as the PLO's name made clear, was to reclaim their entire homeland from Israel by any means, including force. "I was sympathetic to their cause, but not to their tactics," King Hussein told me. There were, however, more than enough sympathizers in the Palestinian refugee camps and communities to shelter the Fedayeen, as the Palestinian freedom fighters were called, and they regularly staged raids against Israel across the border. The Israelis struck back with disproportionate force, destroying Jordanian and Palestinian villages all along the Jordan River Valley. Then came Karami. An established and quite prosperous Palestinian community that had begun as a small refugee camp, Karami was the location of one of Arafat's many command posts in the country. The Palestinians living there had welcomed Arafat and the PLO after the Israelis lobbed artillery shells into Karami in November 1967, killing several schoolgirls on their way home from school. The cycle of attacks and retaliation continued until, on March 21, 1968, Israel sent a massive armored force of 15,000 men into Jordan to wipe out the PLO in Karami. Instead, they were met head-on by the Jordanian army and its armored units. In the fierce battle that followed, Jordanian forces had the upper hand and were actually defeating the Israelis on the ground until the Israeli Air Force was called in. The Israelis managed to raise Karameh, leaving only the mosque, but they paid a heavy price on their retreat to the border. By Jordanian accounts, Jordanian tanks destroyed 20 Israeli tanks and another 25 armored personnel carriers, and killed or wounded more than 200 Israeli soldiers, figures Israel quickly disputed. Jordan lost a sizable number of its tanks and took roughly the same number of casualties, but the psychological victory was enormous for Jordanians. What stunned them was that Arafat immediately claimed it for the PLO, announcing that it was they who had repelled the Israelis. Though that claim has always been disputed, the effect of Karameh has not. Almost overnight, Arafat and his fedayeen became heroes throughout the Arab world for facing down the Israelis. Shortly thereafter, full of bluster, the PLO began to move against King Hussein. Listening to Hussein describe the anarchy that had overtaken Jordan in the wake of the battle at Karameh evoked a tragic and terrifying image. Partisan volunteers from all over the Arab world, even from parts of Africa and Cuba, had rushed to Jordan to join the Palestinian resistance. As the Israelis stepped up their retaliations to fedayeen raids by bombing and napalming Jordanian villages in the Jordan River Valley, the undisciplined PLO armies moved to Amman. Different factions of the PLO set up roadblocks to check identity papers and demand money from motorists. No one, adult or child, could be sure, on leaving home, whether anyone would ever see them again, King Hussein told me. Jordanian army officers and police were taunted, kidnapped, and even killed. Amman became a virtual battlefield, my husband said. King Hussein came under intense pressure to strike back at the PLO, especially from the armed forces who were being so humiliated. But he held them back. "What did they expect me to do?" he said. "What should I do to a people who were driven from their country, who had lost everything? Shoot them?" He met several times with Arafat to negotiate a return to order, but Arafat claimed he could not control the streets either. Still, Hussein held his army back. "I kept hoping the fedayeen would come to their senses and remember that the battle was not between fellow Arabs, but against the Israeli occupation," King Hussein said. In response to the rockets the PLO was now firing across the border, Israeli reprisals grew more violent along the whole Jordan River Valley, from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee. "I was very worried about what was almost perpetual fighting," Hussein recounted. "In some places, the Palestinians had rigged their rocket launchers to timers behind our army lines, setting up the army to take the brunt of the retaliations. In other places, we had to take our army units away from the ceasefire line to try to contain the Palestinians, which left the border very vulnerable." With his country in jeopardy, both internally and externally, Hussein secretly contacted the Israelis in March 1970. "I wanted them to know that it was not an army that was fighting them, but people resisting the occupation of their country," King Hussein told me. His meeting with the Israelis continued in the spirit of his grandfather's efforts to explore a negotiated settlement with the Israelis that would not compromise Palestinian rights or Palestinian territory. "He knew, and I knew, there was no future in war, no future in continued suffering for both our people," my husband told me. "I wanted to have a direct dialogue with the Israelis, whether it led anywhere or not. I could not just sit idly by, not knowing what their thinking was." This approach, best summed up by his oft-mentioned phrase, "engagement is not endorsement," would be one that he would employ over many years of negotiations. In this instance, King Hussein also wanted to make sure the Israelis were not going to take advantage of the inner turmoil in Jordan. By meeting them, he was putting himself at even greater risk, given the inflamed emotions of 1970. But he believed he had no choice. He was losing control of his own country to the PLO, and could not afford an offensive from Israel at the same time. With a unified army of sorts under the rubric of the Palestinian Resistance Movement, and PLO leaders roaring around Amman in motorcades with armed escorts, the Fedayeen were establishing what was essentially a state within a state in Jordan. They saw King Hussein as an obstacle to the PLO cause because of his commitment to a peaceful settlement with Israel. Twice, he came very close to being killed by the PLO in ambushes. Other members of the royal family were targeted as well. Sharif Zayd bin Shakir, the king's cousin, whom we all called Abu Shakir, was at army headquarters in June 1970, when his mother's house and the house next door, which belonged to Prince Ali bin Nayef, came under intense PLO artillery fire. Princess Wijdan, Ali's wife, told me later how she was awakened at 6 a.m. by the sound of shelling and bullets hitting the house. She gathered her terrified children under the dining room table and was trying to calm them when a round hit the house so hard the chandelier fell from the ceiling and smashed onto the table. Soon afterward, she heard on the radio that the PLO had agreed to a ceasefire. Why, then, did the shelling of their house continue? Prince Ali, an intelligence staff officer of the 3rd Royal Armored Division, who had been condemned to death by the PLO, happened to be at home that day. He called Army headquarters to be told that the PLO did not consider the ceasefire to apply to him or his family. They told him that the family of Prince Ali did not deserve to live, Wijdan would recall. I was getting hysterical, and he told me to calm down. Prince Ali then called Arafat, who responded that the shelling was continuing because Jordanian soldiers outside Abu Shakir's house were firing back at the PLO gunmen. Prince Ali telephoned the house. When Abu Shakir's sister, Sharifa Joza, answered, he told her to tell the Jordanian soldiers outside to hold their fire. "Call to them from downstairs," he told her. "The PLO are shooting down at the house from the minaret in the mosque, and the roof is exposed." Sharifa Joza put the phone down, and soon afterward Prince Ali heard a burst of machine gun fire and a scream. Abu Shakir's mother eventually came back on the line to say that Joza had gone up on the roof to contact the soldiers, and the PLO had shot her. She was dead. The two families and Sharifa Joza's body were eventually evacuated by ambulances that continued to be fired upon by the PLO. After delivering the families safely to civil defense headquarters, Prince Ali arranged to send his wife and children to London and then returned to work. It was, the 1967 war veteran said, the most difficult day of his life. The PLO was more in control of Amman than we were, Prince Ali would tell me. Amman was their city, not ours. Flush with power, a particularly militant faction of the Palestinians then proceeded to spend the international political capital they had gained at Karame, replacing it with an unsavory reputation as terrorists. During 1 week in September 1970, 4 passenger airplanes were hijacked by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, led by George Habash. 3 of the aircraft were forced to land in Jordan. The hijackings infuriated King Hussein, who called them the shame of the Arabs. Listening to him recount the episode 8 years later, I could see he was still deeply troubled by the hostages' ordeal. He considered it an absolute outrage that his country was violated by these hijackers, and as a form of penance and apology, he would maintain a lifelong correspondence with people on those planes. The hijackings gave the West, as well as the Arab world, a negative view of the PLO. Both Egypt and Iraq withdrew their support of the PFLP, as did Arafat, but the anarchy did not subside. Although the hostages were released, the PFLP blew up all three aircraft. Arafat could not control the PLO extremists in Jordan's cities, and the Jordanian security forces restrained from action were on the verge of mutiny. 10 days after the first hijacking, King Hussein formed a military government headed by a Palestinian brigadier general, Mohammed Daoud. He and other government members contacted Arafat one last time to try to negotiate a return to law and order, but Arafat rebuffed their efforts. "Tell King Hussein the only concession I will give him is 24 hours to leave the country." With the gauntlet thrown down by Arafat, Hussein finally ordered the Jordanian army to move against the PLO. The army began to flush out the PLO city by city, refugee camp by refugee camp, street by street, house by house. The operation would take 10 months and would be agonizing for the king, who had tried everything to avoid a situation where Arabs were fighting Arabs. "It was the most difficult year of my life," he told me. The fighting was especially fierce in the center of Amman, near the royal palaces. King Hussein's grandfather, King Abdullah I, had forbidden any building on the hillside overlooking the palaces for security reasons. But King Hussein, pressed by the influx of Palestinian refugees, had allowed them to build there. "They had suffered so much already, I could not deny them," he told me. He almost paid for his kindness with his life. The Besman Palace compound came under heavy PLO shelling from that hillside during the confrontation. The commander of the palace guard discovered that one of the palace cooks was giving signals to the PLO as to Hussein's whereabouts in an effort to kill him. King Hussein survived, but the palace was gouged and pockmarked by bullets and rocket shells, constant reminders to us of the Palestinian tragedy that continues to this day. Electricity and telephone service failed in the violence, shutting off Jordan from the outside world. Foreign journalists holed up in Amman somehow got news out, but because their sources were the PLO, their reports were slanted. It fell to King Hussein, an avid ham radio operator, to use his radio to communicate information on the situation. Sharing information with other ham radio operators around the world, I would soon discover, was a passion of his. Wherever we stayed together, even outside the country, he would always have a small ham radio unit set up in our house, be it in England, the mountains of Austria, or Washington, D.C. During this dangerous period in 1970, his hobby actually played a useful role, as it would again when he saved a ship from sinking off Hong Kong. In that instance, the port authority in Hong Kong Harbor had no idea that there was a ship in distress 200 miles offshore. For some reason, they could not receive the ship's distress signals. But Hussein did, and managed to get the information to the proper authorities. In 1970, however, the radio served as his own lifeline. Jordan's very survival was hanging in the balance. On September 19, 1970, the second day of the campaign against the PLO, the Jordanian military discovered Syrian tanks massing on the border with Jordan. A Jordanian reconnaissance team sent to the area reported back that the Syrians had written "Palestine Liberation Army" on their tanks, a ruse that fooled no one. "We knew very well the Syrians were manning these tanks," Hussein told me. Neither King Hussein nor the Jordanian military command thought the Syrians would actually attack. However, using the pretext that Jordan was under orders from America to destroy PLO positions, Syrian tanks did cross the border the next day and threatened to occupy the northern city of Irbid. "It was the gravest threat in our history," my husband told me. Not only did the Syrians invade Jordan with a big armored force, but also, to further complicate the situation, there were Iraqi troops in the same area who had come in during the 1967 war to protect Jordanian air bases from the Israelis and had stayed on. In those hours, we did not know whether the Syrians and the Iraqis would join forces against Jordan, Prince Raad said. It was touch and go. If they had, we would have been in dire straits. The Iraqis did not support the Syrian invasion. Neither did the Syrian Air Force. Indeed, its commander, Hafez al-Assad, decided that Israel and possibly the American government, which had placed its troops in Europe on alert, would retaliate if Syria moved into Jordan. Assad would later claim that he had defied the orders of his government because he did not want Arabs fighting other Arabs. But the consensus is that his decision was more pragmatic. What is indisputable is that Jordanian ground forces, with the help of the Jordanian Air Force, managed to stop the Syrian advance, despite being greatly outnumbered. "We had to defend ourselves," Abu Shakr would recall. "The enemy is the man who is shooting at you, Arab or not." 2 days later, the Syrians withdrew. The operation was over in 2 weeks, but it would take another 10 months, until July 1971, to root out the last of the Palestinian resistance fighters in Jordan. Arafat tried to flee the country in disguise, but was caught by military intelligence. True to his nature, King Hussein ordered Arafat's release. Hussein was just as forgiving with other captured fedayeen. When a group of commandos were brought to him, and in great fear prostrated themselves in front of him and tried to kiss his feet, he told them to get up, collect their belongings, and leave, free men. "They were my brothers," he told me. The thousands of captured Palestinian fighters being held in Jordanian camps by the army were also treated tolerantly. A large number had come from Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and elsewhere, pretending they were coming to fight Israel, when actually they were coming for political reasons. Most were given the choice of peacefully leaving the country. Many took that option and were sent in trucks into Syria. The Syrians, in turn, kept the fedayeen moving into Lebanon. The rest of the Palestinian refugee population stayed peacefully in Jordan. "We had nothing against them, and they had nothing against us," my husband told me. "They were Jordanian nationals. There was no exodus, except for the PLO resistance fighters." King Hussein had survived. His imminent demise, so widely speculated upon in newspapers around the world, proved to be greatly exaggerated. He had saved his country, and more important, its integrity. Jordan did not descend into the civil war that would rack Lebanon for the next decade. Instead, it united behind the king. Those who had attacked him for not taking action sooner against the PLO were silenced. Hussein's patience and tolerance, not the premature use of force, had saved Jordan from annihilation. However, the PLO had not removed Jordan from its sights. A year later, Wasfi Tal, Jordan's prime minister and a very close friend of King Hussein's, was assassinated in Cairo by the emerging PLO terrorist cell Black September, the same group that would kill members of the Israeli Olympic team in Munich, and was also suspected of shooting Zayd Rifai, the Jordanian ambassador to Great Britain and an old friend of my husband's. The attack in London, which Zayd Rifai, though wounded, miraculously survived, prompted Jordanian security to insist that King Hussein stay outside of London, as his name topped Black September's hit list. Consequently, he bought a house, Castlewood, near London, in Egham, a beautiful part of the English countryside. Castlewood was where Abir, Haya, and Ali stayed when they joined us in England after Hussein and I returned from the Scotland portion of our honeymoon. There the children could run free while we were occupied in the city. We enjoyed picnics with them in the countryside around Castlewood, and took them into London, where we would spend hours feeding the ducks at the Serpentine in Kensington Park. But most entertaining for all were the high-spirited visits to Hamley's toy store, when my husband would indulge the little ones, who would scamper down the aisles with the overladen store staff in their wake. We also visited the Sultan of Oman's mother, Qaboos, who was spending the summer in a beautiful house on the Thames River. The five of us were greeted at the entrance by her close friend, Miriam Zawawi, who would become a dear friend to me as well, and escorted to an incense-scented sitting room where Qaboos was waiting to receive us. She was an extraordinarily regal presence, hennaed, bejeweled, and dressed in a magnificently embroidered caftan. Full of curiosity, affection, and good humor, she had prepared generous gifts for everyone. The children, awestruck, accepted theirs politely and then excused themselves. Hussein and I remained, chatting about family and politics. She was extremely knowledgeable on both topics, asking about every family member by name, and demonstrating a sophisticated awareness of current events. Another happy occasion was a surprise visit of Hussein's oldest son, Abdullah, who had just finished his first year of high school at Deerfield Academy in Deerfield, Massachusetts. I was delighted for the two of them. I understood that those few days in London were an important opportunity for Abdullah to be with his father, and for his father to try to make up for not having been able to visit him and his brother and sisters in the United States earlier in the year, before springing a new wife on everyone. Abdullah stayed with us for several days, and in the evenings after dinner Hussein would arm wrestle or otherwise engage in horseplay with him in our private sitting room on the top floor. Hussein often used to playfully roughhouse with all his children, a way of showing affection, and I tried not to intrude on their private time. It was also perhaps a blessing in disguise that my husband had the distraction of Abdullah's visit, because one evening the accumulation of the pressures of the honeymoon took its toll, and I broke down. Uncharacteristically calling my mother in tears, I told her, "I feel like coming home." I meant it, but she knew, and I knew, that I was not a quitter. I felt better after talking to her, and Hussein, otherwise distracted, never knew about my moment of weakness. But the reality of what lay ahead was sinking in. As a young bride, I would find the passage difficult and often painful. I was entering a complex world over which I had little control. I was married to a man I adored, whose time and attention were stretched to the breaking point. After we returned to Amman from our honeymoon, I realized that I was essentially on my own. Chapter 7. A Young Bride in the Royal Household. All newly married couples go through an adjustment period, and the king and I were no exception. The adjustments were more pronounced for me, of course. I had married into my husband's life much more than he had married into mine. First and foremost was the lack of privacy, which I continued to find very challenging. It was jarring to walk out of even my bedroom to immediately face a valet or a waiter or my husband's aide-de-camp, ADC. Though some people might yearningly fantasize about such personal attention, I found it quite unsettling and intrusive. Over the years to come, I would realize that some of this dissonance was cultural, the difference between a Western sense of privacy and personal space, and an Eastern emphasis on communal identity and space. Following the monarchical tradition in most of the world, I was addressed as Your Majesty, and introduced to other people or referred to in their presence as Her Majesty. It felt strangely impersonal at first, as if a wall of formality were being erected between me and the rest of the world, including family and friends. And I always thought it was quite a mouthful for those people who were in constant contact with me to repeat the phrase over and over in the course of a conversation. Tradition also dictated that people stand when I entered a room. In no way did I feel entitled to this deference. Naturally humble and modest, my husband was nonetheless conscious of the symbolism and the essential authority of his position. Unlike some other Middle Eastern monarchs, however, he made himself as accessible as possible and discouraged excessive subservience and formality. When approached by those determined to prostrate themselves or kiss his hand, Hussein would gently help them up and shake their hands instead. I learned from watching him and tried to trust my instincts, sensing that I would be able to strike my own balance. My attachment to Jordan and Jordanians came very naturally, but it was harder to define exactly what my role should be in terms of contributing to the well-being of the country. I remember one day quite early in our marriage, when I was feeling particularly at sea, I asked Hussein to give me some kind of direction. "How can I be most helpful?" He answered, "I have complete faith in you. You have never made a mistake." It was an unequivocal vote of confidence, and I felt a great wave of affection for him when he said it. But still, he had not answered my question. As with all new couples, we also had to adjust to such basic patterns as our different sleeping habits. My husband was a night person who stayed up very late, a nocturnal rhythm I had barely kept pace with during our courtship when I was still keeping regular office hours at the airline. I did not have that morning deadline after we married, and I tried to train myself to match his routine and sleep later in the morning. Sometimes I managed it, but sometimes not. I remained a day person, naturally awaking almost every day by 6:30 a.m. after staying up with him late into the night. In truth, life with King Hussein was forcing me to stretch in every direction. Given the constant threats to his life and the political maelstrom that always surrounded him, I had to develop a new approach to life, that, God willing, I would make the best of every day we were granted. There were days, though, that defied such an attitude. As a young bride in a royal household, I began by observing, trying to understand, to tread softly and not upset the daily routine or question the way things were done. However, as I gradually began to express my opinions, I inevitably ruffled feathers. I had several skirmishes with the British chief of the household. His official title was Controller of the Royal Household, and I would come to realize that he took his job description quite literally. Shortly after moving into the palace, I noticed that most lights remained on throughout the night, even after the family retired. Each night I went around turning them off, suggesting we could reduce the waste of energy. My explanation seemed to fall on deaf ears, the implication being that anyone living in a palace should not be concerned with conserving energy. Perhaps our disparate views on the subject were partly cultural. The energy crisis in the United States had made many Americans, including my family, quite conscious of the cost of consumption. The message I took from this exchange was that I could not assume anything about the way the royal household would be run. Even my husband's diet was a point of contention. During a medical checkup in the United States, the doctors assigned us a top nutritionist, Amal Nasser, a young Jordanian, who urged the king to modify his diet to reduce his cholesterol and triglyceride counts. As hard as I tried to work out a healthier diet with the controller, I had little success. "Oh, come on, Your Majesty," he once said to me patronizingly. So we struggled, he and I. After all, he had been in his position there for all of 2 years, and did not see why he should make any adjustments to a young, new queen. My situation was not unique. Negotiating with pre-existing staff, as I would learn from sharing stories with other royal consorts, was a universal challenge. A royal spouse's entourage and household staff is often territorial and quite entrenched in their habits. I learned how personally every suggestion was taken, whether the issue was food with the controller, or clothing with the king's valet, or planning an official meal with protocol. My suggestions, I began to realize, were often viewed as tacit criticisms of the way things were being done, and occasionally as personal insults. When I tried to liven up Hussein's wardrobe with striped shirts or new ties or more comfortable shoes, they would quietly disappear from the closet, His valet, whom I liked very much, resented my involvement in dressing the king, which he viewed as his job alone. Once, on our aircraft as we returned home from England, my husband mused that every time he would buy himself a pair of ballet shoes, they would vanish. Hussein then noted that his most recent ballet acquisition was remarkably similar to a pair of shoes being worn by a staff member walking past our seats at that very moment, and he complimented the man on his taste. It turned out that the shoes were the very ones Hussein had just bought, passed on to the man by the king's valet, who had reportedly said, "His Majesty will never wear them." Though some of these early incidents with the staff were more amusing than annoying, I found it puzzling that when I thought I was communicating very clearly and diplomatically, I would discover that I was not. Perhaps we were all a little out of sorts. Certainly both staff and family were living in physically trying circumstances. Repairs had already begun on Hashemiyah Palace, so we were awakened early every morning by jackhammers on the roof over our heads. The engineering problems at Hashemiyah would prove to require extensive repairs and renovation. Even before this became clear, Hussein had asked me to begin a quick renovation of Al-Diafa, the guest place in the Basman compound in the original heart of the city, where his grandfather, King Abdullah I, had built the first Jordanian Hashemite palace, Rahadan. When we moved in around a year later, Hussein changed the name of Al-Diafa to Al-Nadwa, which identified our home as a place for all to gather. To be honest, even if we could have fixed all of Hashemiyah's problems, I am not sure we would have been happy there. My new husband had never really warmed to its formal marble halls and yearned for a more cozy home for our family. From the moment he had walked into Hashemiyah, he told me, he had felt like a guest, and no doubt it brought back sad memories. He and Queen Alia had just moved in when she was killed, and she was buried on a hillside nearby. I will never forget driving by the gravesite on the way back to the palace with the children, when Abir, who had already lost two mothers, blurted out, "Will Auntie Alexa, my sister, be our mother when you die?" This period of adjustment was in many ways overshadowed by the politics of the region. Just 2 months after my marriage, U.S. President Jimmy Carter invited Egypt's Anwar Sadat and Israel's new hardline Prime Minister Menachem Begin to meet with him at Camp David to negotiate a settlement in the Middle East. Abandoned were the plans for the International Peace Conference in Geneva my husband had been working so hard to arrange. Instead of a united delegation of Palestinians, Syrians, Jordanians, and Egyptians negotiating collectively with Israel, now there would be only Egypt. The announcement brought with it not only the fear that Sadat would negotiate a separate peace for Egypt, but also the suspicion that Camp David was planned to ensure that such a pan-Arab-Israeli conference never took place. It would be very advantageous to Israel to avoid the pressure of such a public forum. King Hussein was not included in the invitation by President Carter because he was seen as potentially complicating the process by National Security Advisors Zbigniew Brzezinski and by Sadat. Hussein's unwavering insistence on Israel's withdrawal from all territories occupied since 1967 and the right of self-determination for the Palestinians made him a potential obstacle in their eyes rather than a partner for the political victory they hoped to achieve. In his preoccupation with the pending talks at Camp David, my husband neglected to tell me about the Sunday family gatherings at the Queen Mother's house, Zahran Palace. Our children had been visiting her regularly on Sunday afternoons with the nannies, and my husband and I would visit more erratically, but it was many months before I discovered that all the Queen Mother's offspring and their families were expected on a weekly basis. Unwittingly, I had made my first family faux pas, at least the first of which I was aware. The Queen Mother was born Sharifa Zain al-Sharaf in Egypt in 1916, and had married her first cousin, then Crown Prince Talal, at age 18. She had raised 4 children and had been a pioneer for women's rights by sponsoring the first women's union in Jordan and the women's branch of the Jordan National Red Crescent Society. Also, she may well have influenced her husband's contribution to Jordan's 1952 constitution, which gave full rights to women. Her husband's descent into mental illness could not have been easy for her, but Queen Zane bore these difficulties with great strength, especially after her father-in-law, King Abdullah, was killed and her husband was hospitalized abroad. After King Talal abdicated, Queen Zane played a significant role while her 17-year-old son finished his schooling, before his accession to the throne on his 18th birthday. Once Hussein became king, Queen Zane focused mostly on her family. When I first began attending the Sunday afternoon gatherings at Zahran, I had no idea of what the family conventions were, or what their expectations were of me. I knew only that I was, understandably, the subject of intense curiosity and comment. In the absence of guidance, I followed my own instincts and tried to be polite and respectful, but I had to also be myself. Otherwise, I would have gone mad. It was among the children that I felt most natural and spontaneous. One Sunday, the children all filed in and kissed Queen Zane's hand, then disappeared into the garden to play, while the adults sat with the Queen Mother. I could see that some of the younger children, including our 3, were at a disadvantage in the game with their older siblings and cousins. To restore the balance, I leaped in and tackled one of the older boys. The children were startled, needless to say, to see their new auntie suddenly charging across the lawn at them. But I managed to hang on to the 12-year-old boy, who turned out to be Prince Ghazi, Prince Mohammed's son, just long enough so that the little children could win. I do not know how this affected the adults' impression of me, but I rated high praise from Ghazi and his brother Talal, who pronounced me cool. My husband loved his nephews and nieces as though they were his own children. One story that Talal and Ghazi frequently repeated was the mystery of the missing nephews. It involved King Hussein's first helicopter, then the only one in Jordan, and the boys, who would hear its roaring blades and run out into their garden to wave. King Hussein would land the helicopter on the lawn, scoop them up, and say, "Where do you want to go?" He would then fly them around Amman on a modern magic carpet ride before redepositing them in their garden. The boys' parents, not unreasonably, would demand to know where the boys had disappeared to. "Uncle took us away in a helicopter," the boys would reply, which would make the parents even angrier. "Don't make up stories," they would scold the boys. I am astonished, looking back at the beginning of my marriage, at how vulnerable I was to gossip and criticisms of all sorts. The rumor mill in Amman was already churning out what would become a panoply of preposterous stories over the years. On Queen Alia's death, rumors had quickly spread about the cause of her helicopter accident. The most incredible of these insisted that the Queen Mother had somehow arranged the crash. When my engagement to Hussein was announced, I discovered later, rumors had spread that the CIA, in fact, had been responsible for Queen Alia's accident as part of a plan to plant me on the throne. It was also said that I had a black child in America, and my husband was being blackmailed by the father, who threatened to sell the photos to People magazine. My sister, who was in law school in Texas at the time, had opened a boutique on Madison Avenue in New York to resell my royal wardrobe. I had bought an Asian island on one of our trips to the Far East. And always there were stories about fantasy purchases of extravagant jewelry, marital turbulence, and pregnancies and miscarriages. My husband, who was inured to the gossip in Jordan, brushed off these stories, and I struggled to as well. I knew that women in my position in the past, whether in Iran or in Jordan, the United States or Europe, had been similarly gossiped about, whether there was cause or not. I also knew that virtually every member of the family was the focus of constant imaginings. Over time, I learned that such stories more often than not reflected the values, inclinations, and fantasies of the storytellers, and should therefore not be taken personally. However, I never quite adjusted to the fact that people would believe them so readily. I cannot remember now what triggered it. The gossip, the lack of privacy, the frustrations with the management of Hashimiya. But one day I needed a change, and persuaded a very reluctant Meliha to assist in my subterfuge. I slid into her passenger seat, and averted my face from the scrutiny of the guards as we drove through the palace gates into the freedom of the outside world. Meliha was very nervous. I directed her to our friends, Suha and Khalid Shoman, with whom I then spent a wonderful, carefree couple of hours chatting and drinking tea, and not responding to the increasingly frantic calls from the palace trying to determine my whereabouts. When I realized that I was causing our loyal and dedicated royal guards a great deal of distress, I returned home, and never again indulged myself in this way, but it provided a badly needed respite at the time. What I really wanted to do was to concentrate on what I could contribute to my marriage and to Jordan. At the beginning, finding my way was difficult. Although I fulfilled a few ceremonial roles, I was